Good morning, my name is Sinu Reddy and I'm here with my colleagues, Dr. Baker, Dr. Wen, and Dr. O'Gara, and we're going to spend a few minutes talking about developing and maintaining good relationships with referring physicians. If you'd like to introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Dr. Craig Baker, the Chief of Cardiac Surgery at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. My practice mainly consists of adult cardiac surgery and adult congenital cardiac surgery.
I'm Pat O'Gara, I'm a cardiologist from Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. I am also past president of the American College of Cardiology and the vice chair of the Cardiothoracic Surgery Network, which is an NHLBI sponsored network looking at randomized trials in cardiac surgery. I've had now a nearly 40-year experience at the interface between cardiology and cardiac surgery.
My name is Tom Wen. I'm a cardiac surgeon in Houston, Texas, and I have a particular interest in treating patients with structural heart disease. So My case mix involves transcatheter valve disease as well as minimally invasive valve repair and replacement. I'm the director of minimally invasive valve surgery in Houston as well as the co-director of the structural heart program.
Again, my name is Sinu Reddy. I'm an adult cardiac surgeon in Nashville, Tennessee at TriStar Centennial Medical Center. And I specialize in, like Dr. Wen, in structural heart disease, minimally invasive valve procedures, and minimally invasive coronary bypass surgery. So with that, let's start off just talking a little bit about what you do when you get a patient and how you develop that relationship with the physician that sent you that patient.
I'm a firm believer in communication with all my referrals and my patients and make sure that the communication is very clear. So the very first thing I do is I receive the phone call from the cardiologist and then we very expeditiously see the patient. I think it's important that it really is a patient-centered experience. We see the patient as quickly as possible and come up with a game plan and relay it to the patient, make sure they fully understand all the various treatment options. And very quickly after that, I talk back to my cardiologist to make sure that they're in the loop as well. Afterwards, the operation, again, I communicate with the patient's family and my cardiologist to make sure that they are in the loop and see if they have anything else to add regarding patient care.
So after the operation you may perform on your patient, do you make it a point always to call the cardiologist on the same day, the next day, and how do you kind of develop that rapport?
I try to employ a little bit of checks and balance. So after I walk out of the operating room, I will either call or send a message to the cardiologist. And I also have a system in place with my assistants that will generate an automatic letter to the cardiologist with all the information from my operative note so that they actually have a physical letter in their mailbox within the next couple of days. Again, I think communication is so important. I think Dr. Guerra can probably attest that they appreciate hearing about how the patient's doing, because sometimes they'll get a patient referral maybe two, three, a month ago, and things might get lost, but when they hear, hey, the patient had an operation, he or she's doing well, I think it's appreciated.
Oh, very much so, Tom. I think that the bottom line is that it's really best for patient care that level of communication occurs. I think that in modern practice, there are many obstacles in our paths in order to achieve effective communication. We're so busy, and there's a certain degree of anonymity that has descended onto the electronic health record that allows people to communicate as if we are all in the third person. So we refer to ourselves as the cardiac surgeon, or you're from anesthesia, or the cardiologist sent me the patient. And I think that there are fewer and fewer cardiologists who've taken care of patients over a lifespan, because the practice of cardiology and cardiac surgery has been parceled down into solvable chunks, a procedure, for example. We need to take a step back from that and remember that many of these patients are brought along longitudinally by an internist and a cardiologist with respect to decision making. And it's very important for the patient and the family that those people be in communication with you, because oftentimes we are asked to translate what happened, especially if there's a complication. And as you know, the degree of sophistication around cardiac surgical complications varies as a function of the cardiologist with whom you're dealing. Gone are the days when cardiologists visited the operating room and actually saw what was happening. And in my training at MGH 40 years ago, That was expected. And that was the mechanism by which we were placed in the direct line of communication between the surgeon and the family. And that is a practice that has long since gone by the wayside as we've sort of moved into our own silos. So I think this is an incredibly important topic, and I'm really grateful that the STS would bring it forward. I think we all aspire to doing this, but on a daily basis, it's hard.
You raised a lot of great points that we're going to come back to. I want to turn to you, Dr. Baker, if you could make a few comments on how you particularly, you're at a teaching facility, a major mm-hmm. teaching facility, how you teach residents on developing the communication. Are there special challenges that you face when patients get referred into a teaching facility?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important that we demonstrate to our residents how to communicate with referrings and how important that is, especially because we do afford them an increasing amount of autonomy, and you don't want the communication with referrings to get lost as they kind of take over patient care. I can't emphasize enough that I completely agree with everything that's been said. What we try and do is, and I think there's a few, I'll just add to Tom's comments a little bit, a few, especially for the residents, they need to understand that when you get out in practice, no one's raising their hand and dying to send you a patient. And it takes a good 5 years or so to develop a reputation and build a practice. And the best way you can do that is to start on day one and call every referring and communicate, especially because that's the time you have the most time to do it. I just add a couple things and I'll answer your question. You know, a few things I think are specifically important. If you're going to see a patient in clinic, mm-hmm. and it's a little unclear before you see the patient exactly what maybe the referring was thinking or what decision tree you're going to go down, see if you can get in touch with that referring before you go talk to the patient. It's really nice to have a plan, and the patient, you go in there and you talk about, you know, doing a surgical aortic valve replacement for 20 minutes, and the patient says, "Oh God, Dr. O'Gara sent me here for TAVR." I mean, exactly. You know, you should know that ahead of time.
Right.
And so, you know, having those discussions with the cardiologist before you see the patient, give the patient a comprehensive plan that builds a lot of confidence. And then, you know, one of my partners, I think, suggested I be here, said, you know, look at every patient operation you do as an opportunity to call the referring, let them know what happened. So my kind of mantra, like Tom's a little bit, is the first phone call I make when I'm done with an operation is to the referring if I have the number.
I'll add to Dr. Baker's comments a little bit. You know, the reality is that the patients actually have more of a relationship with the cardiologist than they do with us. You know, the cardiologist would have follow the patients for many years, and this is the first time seeing it. So it's not uncommon that after I come with a game plan, the patient will say, "Hey, does Dr. So-and-so know about this?" And fortunately, most of the time, we know and we've communicated with the cardiologist beforehand. So I agree with that. I think it's very important to make sure at least we're sort of on the same page before going and seeing the patient, and then making sure that the patient knows that, hey, it's a team effort. We're both on the same page, and we're doing this together. And afterwards, you know, our cardiologist is going to be helping to take care of the patient afterwards.
The other little thing I've learned to do, which I think is really good for the cardiologist to see, and it helps you just remember, you know, when you're seeing someone a year out, is every time I talk about my indications for operation, for example, I will dictate so-and-so is a 67-year-old gentleman referred to me by my colleague, Dr. Yes. So-and-so. And number one, the referrings, I think, really appreciate seeing their name in the note, and it reminds you every time you see that patient who the referring was in case something comes up. Answer your question about the residents.
Yeah.
You know, I think how you exemplify to residents is modeling the behavior. And I think the opportunity to really get residents involved in communication is through the hospital course. And the other part we haven't talked about is how important it is to keep the referrings up to date for good problems or bad problems, for complications. Last thing any referring wants to have happen is to be caught off guard by a family member says, "Oh, can you believe they had a stroke? And, you know, didn't know that happened." So when we round, we often tell our residents or our team, you know, "I'm going to call Dr. So-and-so and update on what happened." Or would you do that? Especially for cardiologists at our own institution who are used to communicating with the residents.
That's a great point. A topic you touched on, Dr. Baker, is that a lot of these patients do have longitudinal relationships that may even go upstream from their cardiology sources, for example, internal medicine or family practice. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's important that cardiac surgeons somehow loop those folks in, or do you think that's the responsibility of the cardiologist?
I think we can help you there. I think that your time is extraordinarily valuable. Between being on top of your game to perform these life-saving and life-altering operations, the team can help you. And I think as long as communication across this multidisciplinary team to which we all aspire is at a very top level, then the points of communication outside of the team can oftentimes be delegated effectively. But on occasion, you have to have the sense that an internist or a family practitioner, or in some cases, another specialist who has a closer relationship with the patient, a diabetologist, for example,
perhaps,
wants a phone call from the cardiac surgeon, that's easy enough to arrange. I think that it's very important for us to breed familiarity, to be in touch with each other frequently, so we know each other's reflexes and we know each other's values, but not to let those very important things slip through the cracks. I think there's a high degree of variability with respect to what's placed in an electronic health record. If you go back and audit, for example, what might happen to somebody through a cardiac operation and recovery, oftentimes you see that team members were somewhat detached, say at the level of the physician assistant, the nurse practitioner, or the resident on the service, begins to make medication changes, and then the patient ends up with a dozen or so at time of discharge. And that's another inflection point around which communication could be had with a referring cardiologist or accepting cardiologist who's likely to see the patient sooner in follow-up than the surgical team to help try to bring some sort of clarity to what the package should be. I think that's a very common source of potential trouble. As you know, people go home with various volume conditions, rhythm states, anticoagulation, potassium supplements, Lasix for 5 days or some equivalent of that. And most of the time they get through just fine, but occasionally I think some communication beforehand could help bring some structure to that.
One thing I do, very similar like you, Tom, is after the operation, I dictate my operative note. I do make sure that a copy goes to the primary care physician as well. That's kind of one of the ways I do to loop them in, because I think at the end of the day, they might have the longest continuity of care. And it's more. Let's touch a little bit on when and how do we communicate that bad news to our referring physician. So let's say maybe a patient post-op day three has a sudden cardiac death. We don't exactly know what happened. How do you manage that situation?
You know, I think obviously bad things happen, and it happens to all of us. I think the best way to approach that is to be very transparent and honest. Yeah. I think patients appreciate that, and if we explain it in a very systematic way to let the patient and their families know that we really did the best we could, we had all the available resources available, nothing's perfect in our world, but we really did the best we could with our available resources to do what's best for the patient. 9.9 times out of 10, the patient's families are okay with that. So I think it's important to be transparent. I think the tricky thing and what gets people into trouble is if you try to cover it up and sweep it under the rug, or if you try to point fingers and, right, and blame others. And I think there's an element of, you know, at times it's okay to take some responsibility and tactfully doing so, but I think patients and their families appreciate that.
I think it's a big referral center that you're at. It's a hard phone call to make, isn't it, when you have to call that specialist that sent you that patient? But I'm sure you probably don't delegate that to the resident, right? That's a phone call that
you make. No, I think you have to lead by example in that setting, and certainly, you know, I mean, most often you're going to be dealing with referrings, hopefully, that you have long-standing relationships with. And I think that's why it's so important, you know, for new trainees to not start off and bite off more than they can handle. Because the last thing you want to do is make that phone call two or three times in a row.
Yeah. As the new surgeon
on the block. As the new surgeon on the block. So, you know, I think be very smart about your case selection when you start off. Try and pick things that are going to give you very safe, reliable results so you build up a great reputation. And then once you have that reputation, everyone understands there's going to be complications. And if they know you're a good, safe surgeon and this happened, you make a phone call and explain what happened, I think everybody understands that.
Yeah, I often find we're hardest on ourselves. It's a really hard phone call to make, but I have to say, any cardiology colleague I've ever called, they've been so understanding.
They
often say to me, well, I know you did the best you could.
Absolutely.
Or, boy, that patient sure was sick. I didn't expect him to pull through or something. So they're very kind in that way.
Right. And I think that cardiologists should approach this from the point of view of, we own this decision-making process as much as you do. So it starts with a cardiologist referring a case to a cardiac surgeon, and we need to understand what those risks are. For example, a patient who's a reoperative candidate with tricuspid valve disease and right ventricular dysfunction, we need to own that decision making. We're putting you in a position and the patient in a position of peril. Mm-hmm. Same thing is true of our interventional colleagues. The things we delegate to them, literally on our behalf, are sometimes beyond the pale. We need to own that kind of decision making process. And when complications happen, it's a team complication. And we all share in that. We all learn from it, and then we can all communicate more effectively, I think, to the patient and family.
Going a little bit into more of the nuances of communication, how do you develop how you like to be communicated with? For example, a text message, as Dr. Nguyen alluded to, is it a phone call that you need? And then the other thing is, how much detail do you really want? Do you want the phone call to say, I operate on Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and they're doing fine? Do you want it, I just came out of the operating room, this is what I did, and tell every vessel that you bypassed and what kind of valve you put in? How do you kind of develop that level of nuance in communication?
Well, I think that, again, it comes back to how well you know each other and the frequency over the course of a working week in which you actually interact with each other, whether it's over a phone call or whether you have a minute in a hallway to say, you know, I'm not really sure that I'm thinking clearly about this problem. And the more often we do that, then the easier it gets to communicate between ourselves, whether it's a text, Mr. Smith had four vessel CABG with mitral valve repair doing well. That's all I need to know in order to get through my day, and I can pick up the pieces as the operative note becomes available over the next couple of days. Probably not important for me to know those details, frankly,
right.
Unless and until complications occur, and then there's a written record. I think the other point in this is that we also have to consider the level of communication around the difficult case before a decision is made. So when we're dealing with postoperative complications, but let's just say that I'm putting you in a position in which you're uncomfortable. There's something about this patient. It doesn't equate on an STS risk score, but in your experience and in your judgment, you're not sure you can help this patient under the circumstances in which you're inheriting them. So how do we have that kind of a conversation, and how do we actually encourage each other to seek second opinions, whether it's a cardiology second opinion, a heart failure second opinion, a surgical second opinion, or an interventional second opinion? I think that we're sometimes a bit defensive about our own decision making, and then the next thing you know, it's awkward. And that's not in the patient's best interest, but I'd just be curious as to how you guys handle that.
Yeah, you know, I think it is a little varied on what kind of institution you're at. I mean, you're part of kind of a multimodality institute model. I think those conversations are easier. If anything, I think it's usually, I find the opposite, where in the sense that the cardiologist will often say, hey, I just want to run something by you. I don't think this patient's really an operative candidate. And then you often see him and say, you know, I think we can do a lot of good here. And usually the cardiologist is like, oh, great. So that, you know, that actually happens quite a bit as well. It obviously can go both ways. I think it's very easy to just acknowledge when these complex decisions happen, say, you know, you might be right, this guy may be too sick, or should it be a candidate? You know, let me get one of my partners to take a look and just give another opinion. And I think if you're honest about it, it doesn't make anybody look weak or at fault. It is just, we live in a complex world these days, and patients aren't going to be black and white. More often, they're very gray.
One other kind of complex situation that I think occurs sometimes is, what do you do when you're the on-call physician for the weekend? You're covering your partners or your practice, and then there's an adverse event. How do you handle that? I can tell you what I try to do is, the first phone call I actually make is to my partner. Mm-hmm. I want them to know what's happened, and then I leave it to them. Would you like me to call the referring and let them know, or would you like to know? How do you guys handle that, or with residents on call? Do you expect for the resident to call the surgeon that did the operation, or do you just let the weekend guy handle it? Or what are recommendations, and what would you like to see from the cardiology standpoint?
Well, I think certainly the surgeon of record would want to know at our institution, and we have very open dialogue with our residents that are on call, so I'm more than happy to let the resident call my partner,
right,
let them know what's going on, or I'll do that. I think as far as then reaching out to the referring cardiologist that weekend for serious things, I think that's something that my partner would decide amongst ourselves. More often than not, if it's my patient and I'm not on call and something really serious happened, I'd still want to call that cardiologist
sure.
myself.
If I'm covering a patient and something bad happens, and then it's, by definition, if I'm covering the patient, I actually don't have a full picture of what's going on. So before I talk to the patient, I want to make sure I have all the information available at hand. So I make sure I talk to my partner, but also I want to make sure I talk to the cardiologist, see if there's any insight to explain what happened. And then that actually gives me a little more kind of backing when I actually eventually talk to the patient's family. So I think that's important. Talk to the patient's family, explain to them the unfortunate event that happened, but tell them, you know, we spoke to the referring as well as to the surgeon involved to make sure they know that everyone has been roped in and is in the loop.
Great. Well, as we close up and wrap up, a couple of final thoughts. I think we can all agree that good communication is something that has to be learned and practiced, and that it involves being very diligent and deserves our attention. Any final closing thoughts as we wrap up here?
No, I think we've said a lot. I do think it's very important that we, like I said before, lead by example and kind of teach the residents below us how important this is. Like you said, you don't want to lose this because they're sitting in front of the EMR so oftentimes. There's a very personal aspect of medicine that I think it's very important that we impart to the next generation.
Go ahead, Tom. I think that every time you get into trouble, most of the time, it's because of miscommunication.
Sure.
And I think whatever we can do to be as effective communicators as possible, and if anything, you should err on over-communicating, the better. And at the end of the day, we deal with complicated patients, and to your one of your scenarios, if we have a complex patient, the unique thing about our program is we have a heart team. So
sure.
If it's a patient that we don't know the right answer to, or you might have differing opinions, I could tell our cardiologist, we're going to present this patient, our heart team, we're very objective about it, we have a lot of different minds to come together with the goal of making the best decision for our patient. And I come back to the cardiologist and say, hey, we presented the patient at our structural heart meeting, and this is what we came up with.
Great point.
And 9 times out of 10, the referring is okay with that.
Any closing thoughts, Dr. Rivera?
Well, thanks very much. I'm really delighted to be part of this great conversation. I think that communication is an active process that takes a certain degree of energy, and it must be accorded the highest priority.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.